Okay, so one of the less understood things about an hour-long podcast is that it actually takes quite a few hours behind the scenes to make. You're lining up different people's schedules, you're writing scripts, editing audio, making it feel effortless actually takes a bit of effort. That's why I want to recommend Notion. Notion is a place where any team can write, plan, organize, and rediscover the joy of play. It's a workspace designed not just for making progress, but getting inspired too, so that when it comes time to hit the record button, everyone's on the same page, or TeamSpace, or Calendar, or QuickNote, have a play around, they're all there. Notion combines your collaborations into one space that's simple and clear, and it also has some AI running in the background to help things along. Try Notion for free when you go to notion.com/squared. And just an FYI, that's all lowercase letters, notion.com/squared, lowercase. So you can start turning ideas into action. And when you use the link, you're supporting what we do here on the show too. That's notion.com/squared.
What can you do when your friends get sick of you prying into their problems?
Do what everyone else is doing, of course. Start a podcast.
Introducing If I Speak, a brand new podcast from me, Ash Sarkar.
And me, Moya Lothi McLean, where we pitch each other our big theories about the universe, share the intrusive thoughts keeping us up at night, and best of all, tackle your personal dilemmas.
We'll be asking questions like, does tabloid gossip turn us all into conspiracy theorists?
Should you financially support a parent?
Is Moya turning into a bit of a femcel?
Yes. What's Ash's most toxic trait?
Interrupting. From dating disorders to family feuds, career dilemmas to online etiquette,
the political gets personal on If I Speak.
Find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's gossip elevated.
Welcome to Intelligence Squared. I'm Connor Boyle. Coming up, Sally Hayden, the journalist, photographer and author, discusses her new book, which shines a spotlight on the perilous journeys faced by refugees in North Africa and across the world. Sally Hayden is Africa correspondent for the Irish Times. Her work as a journalist and photographer has seen her report from locations including Nigeria, Iraq, Syria, Sierra Leone and more, often focusing on the experiences of those swept up in migration, conflict and humanitarian crisis. Her first book, the recently published My Fourth Time We Drowned, Seeking Refuge on the World's Deadliest Migration Route, continues that work. The book explores not only the dangerous journeys undertaken by those seeking refuge in Europe, but also investigates how politics, NGOs and organizations such as the United Nations can be a problematic part of the bigger picture. Hosting today's discussion is the economist and broadcaster Linda Yu. Here's Linda with more.
Welcome, Sally. Your book is focused on the refugee and migrant crisis in Africa and across the Mediterranean. But we're talking to you at a moment when more than 4 million refugees from the Ukraine have crossed borders into neighboring European countries. What have you made of Europe's response to the Ukraine crisis?
The important thing to say first is that what's happening in Ukraine is horrific, and it's good that refugees from there are being welcomed into Europe, and it's been really heartening to see the kind of responses to them. I think it's also been very shocking for many of us who have been working on documenting what happens to refugees who try to get into Europe, in the sense that there hasn't been this kind of welcome for people who are trying to enter from any of the other borders, essentially. I know that some people, that some journalists that I know that report on it have actually said it's given them kind of a glimmer of hope. They're thinking maybe a more empathetic refugee policy is possible. But at the same stage, you know, what we've been seeing for years now is like really horrific, a pretty horrific response in terms of human rights on Europe's other borders. And so, yeah, it's been strange to witness.
Well, let's get to your area, which is this book that you've written. Can I just ask you, how did you first become interested in telling these stories from the refugee crisis? Gosh, now it's from around 2015, a few years before that, and certainly still ongoing.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there were like refugees and asylum seekers trying to reach Europe a long time before 2015. But as we all know, it kind of came to much broader consciousness in 2015, the year of the so-called European migrant crisis. And at the time, I was a staff journalist for Vice News, based in London. So we saw news reports where David Cameron, I think, used the term swarms of migrants. He said there are swarms of migrants who are trying to reach the UK from Calais in France. And my editor and me had a conversation and basically went, what does that mean? Like, we don't understand. Who are they? Like, where did they come from? What, like, swarms? How many does swarms mean? Like, we, you know, that didn't really make sense as a statement. And so my editor then, Ed Upright, actually said, why don't you just go to Calais and try and meet people and see what's going on? And so I went out. I had reported like a little bit on migration just because I did daily news, you know, so we'd report on when there was a big shipwreck and things like that. But I went out and I had actually been given like 1,000 business cards from my work, which I hadn't. I did a lot of desk reporting, so I hadn't had so much chance to use them all. And I went out to Calais and I realized that like this is a much broader, you know, there's many, many reasons why people would try and reach Europe, would try and reach the UK. And there's also many different situations that they're fleeing from. And it's not, you can't use one term to describe everybody, you know, I mean, that's what we do, but it doesn't really show you the actual reality of what's happening. And I actually went out and started handing out business cards, just like anyone I spoke to, I'd say, take my business card, get in touch if you, you know, have something that you think we should be reporting, or if you get to the UK and want to meet up, like, you know, just stay in touch. And a lot of them did stay in touch. And that was kind of my first, I just started making contacts with like a lot of people who, you know, would be considered as refugees, who started telling me what was happening in their countries. Also a lot about the details of making this type of journey and the, you know, the troubles that they faced even trying to fit into Europe afterwards. And that, yeah, that kind of started me on this path of reporting on this.
We're going to hopefully cover all of that in our time, including you quote some of the messages that they had sent to you throughout the book. So it was such a
yeah, I mean,
very worrying read, I have to say.
I mean, that was a different situation. The question of how I started reporting on migration, that was 2015, but the book begins in 2018.
Yeah.
And that's when I get a message from someone who was in a Libyan migrant detention center. So I hadn't reported on Libya until that point. And those messages quoted in the book are messages coming from detention centers in Libya. Yeah, which is a bit different to what was happening in Calais.
Actually, I want to come to that story of the first person who got in touch with you in a moment. But before that, just you've already begun to describe it, but just tell me a bit about how you conducted the research for this book and actually some of the challenges you faced in trying to get to see the refugee camps and to meet the people.
Yeah, I mean, so first to be clear, like they're not refugee camps. So the book looks at Libyan detention centres, which are effectively prisons where people are locked up indefinitely without legal recourse. And, you know, using the word camps makes it sound nicer than it is. It's not, it's a detention centre. Like Pope Francis has compared them to concentration camps. People can be locked up, hundreds of people in one hole without food, without water, without medical care. So, yeah, they're really not camps, and I wouldn't even call them refugee camps because refugee implies that they're being given some sort of protection, which they're not. The book focuses on what is happening to the roughly 90,000 people now who have tried to cross the central Mediterranean Sea to reach Italy or Malta and have been intercepted through EU policy effectively and forced back into detention centres in Libya. And so this was a result of, you know, pretty much of what we call the European migrant crisis. And it's funny to think about it now because in 2015, 1.3 million people claimed asylum across Europe in the whole year. And like you said, 4 million Ukrainians have already left Ukraine. So when you even compare the size of those things, you know, what sparked all of this backlash against refugees actually wasn't so sizable in comparison to what they're facing now. But the reaction to the migrant crisis was that a lot of more kind of far right political parties started gaining power and figures. And there was kind of a reaction among the EU, like various aspects of the EU, where they decided that they needed to kind of stop people arriving into Europe. And so one of the initiatives that was taken was to support the Libyan Coast Guard. So under international law, European boats can't return people to a country where their lives would be in danger. And so instead of European vessels being able to return people to Libya, because if European vessels rescue boats of refugees, they pretty much have to take them to Europe. So the way to get around that was to support the Libyan Coast Guard by providing them with equipment, with training, and also doing surveillance. So the EU still flies, you know, helicopters, planes, drones to spot refugee boats, but they give that information to the Libyan Coast Guard since 2017. And the Libyan Coast Guard then can legally return refugees to Libya. So I'm sure, like many people, still don't know about this. Since 2017, 90,000 people, men, women and children, have been caught at sea and returned into indefinite detention in Libya for basically just trying to reach Europe.
As you document in your book, refugees who contacted you, they wanted to tell their stories. But you also write about it was hard for them to tell you some parts of the story, wasn't it? Safety-wise, and perhaps you wrote, sometimes they feel shame, you know, most of them wanted to tell you, but getting the story, you know, from them, that in and of itself was, you know, very challenging, wasn't it?
Well, so the book is based on pretty much hundreds of people that I was in touch with who were held across detention centres. And so they were using hidden phones to send the messages. And there was a very real risk that if the information, my source was made public or was released, that they would actually, like, they could literally be tortured. Like, so they were inside the detention center. They were very much in real danger at that time. And so actually people did want to talk. Like, a lot of this ended up just kind of almost as a friendship, like just exchanging conversation, because if you think about it, you have people who literally, some of them hadn't left a hole in a year, you know, they hadn't seen sunlight in a year, they didn't know what was going on, they wanted to know what was happening outside that detention center. And so it wasn't so hard to get information from people, but there was, I mean, actually people would be more open with me than they would be with their family, for example, because they don't want their family to know how much they're suffering. Whereas, like, for me, I was kind of an impartial person who didn't necessarily know their relatives or didn't, I was kind of separate. So they were more willing to tell me how they were feeling, what was happening, what the conditions were like.
I want to come back to your chapter about the importance of the SIM card. But before we do that, I just want to spend a moment on the title of your book. So you titled it My Fourth Time We Drowned. And it's extremely evocative. Tell me about the Somali refugee that you were quoting in as the title of your book. And then crucially, what happened on their fifth attempt?
Yeah, the quote comes from something that a young Somali guy told me, that he had tried to cross the sea three times. All those times he had been intercepted. The fourth time, he says, we drowned. He was with family members and they actually died in that attempt. And the fifth time he personally made it to safety. But I think for me, that quote is quite powerful. I mean, part of me was surprised that other people felt that because they didn't know the whole context. But like for me, that quote was powerful because what happens to refugees when they try to make this journey, it becomes like a communal effort. You know, all of your background, all of your personal identity gets stripped when you're stuck in this situation where you're basically treated as cargo. You know, you get locked up in warehouses, smugglers just move you around like your cargo, you get locked up in detention and nothing really from your previous life matters anymore. And so it becomes like a very communal effort to try and survive this situation. And so actually the book even details like what happens to people who reach Europe. And like that young man, I mean, they can feel that part of them is dead because the people who were with them will, like, everyone that I know who has reached Europe, they have multiple people who have died trying to make that journey. And so they may have survived, but the feeling is like part of them is dead. You know, it's not that they are just celebrating now. So that's what the title meant.
Tell me about the road of death from Sudan to Italy. So what might this journey for a refugee look like? You've already begun to describe it. Why would they brave that particular route? And it was really striking in the book how expensive that it cost.
Yeah, that was definitely what one guy who I interviewed for the book, he called this the route of debt, where it tends to be the people who are coming from what would be termed as refugee-producing countries. So either they're escaping war in maybe Somalia, Darfur and Sudan, South Sudan, or dictatorships like in Eritrea. And they all kind of meet together in Sudan. And in Sudan, in Khartoum, you can find a smuggler. And so it tended to be in Khartoum that they would make deals with smugglers or in close by in Omdurman. And basically what the smugglers do is they offer you, it's kind of like go now, pay later scheme. So you don't pay anything to set off on the journey. But people know that the journey is going to be incredibly dangerous. But the smuggler will say, especially like in around 2017, 2016, they'll say you'll pay maybe $5,000 or it may probably $2,000, but you'll be in Europe in 3 weeks or 1 month. And so people agreed to do this and they set off. They drive across the Sahara Desert, which is incredibly dangerous. There's like not enough water. People die. They're in Hilux jeeps generally. They just are sitting out the back. And if someone dies, which many people describe to me happening, they just throw the body off the jeep and keep driving. When they get to Libya, then at that point, they get locked in a warehouse. And so that's when the amount of money that they've been told they will pay goes up. So generally, if they were told they'd pay $2,000, maybe they'd be told now it's going to be $5,000. And from that point, they're then told, it depended on the smuggler slightly, but generally, like every day, they'd be lined up, told to call their family, told to tell their family they have to pay $5,000. I mean, some people I interviewed, they described like the account details were like on the wall, so they could call them out. They were given like 1 minute to talk to the family members. And if they didn't pay in a certain amount of time, then they began to be tortured or beaten. So, or denied food even. So, yeah. So if you paid quickly, initially, if you paid quickly, then you could move on and potentially try and cross the sea. But if you didn't pay quickly, that's when torture started. Most people I interviewed, they said they stayed there for around 1 year with the smugglers. So it was like not a fast process. And what happened was because the EU started supporting the Libyan Coast Guard in 2017, they stopped being so many people arriving in Libya, which meant that the smugglers were quite desperate to keep making money out of the people who were under their control. So they would have had like thousands of people across various compounds. And what happened was when you paid your $5,000, you would then be sold to another smuggler and made to pay again. So some people I interviewed, they paid this like 2, 3, 4 times. So it went from being what one researcher on this calls the gone from the monetization of travel to the monetization of captivity, basically. And one guy I interview in the book, he literally was gambled away by a smuggler. So the smugglers weren't always in Libya. Sometimes they were off in Dubai. And his smuggler loved gambling and literally gambled away like a few hundred of them to another smuggler.
Wow. You write later in the book about Rwanda. And Rwanda, sort of given how treacherous this course is and what you've described as the EU's policy. So just tell us a little bit about what's happening with the Rwanda position in all of this.
Yeah, so Rwanda isn't on the route at all, and there wouldn't be people leaving Rwanda to try to get to Europe, at least not that I've come across going through Libya. But what happened was there's a EU evacuation scheme, and a UN evacuation scheme. And so this is happening all over the world. It's kind of resettlement, and rich countries can step forward and offer spaces for refugees. And there really aren't enough spaces offered. So before coronavirus, the UN was evacuating about 2,000 people a year, which was much less than the number who needed it, even much less than the numbers who were detained. But because they can't do a proper full, you know, the countries that offer spaces, they make a lot of requirements in terms of the interviews and things that have to be carried out before someone can be moved there. So UN first had a transit country, it's basically in Niger, and then that became full because they moved people there that then weren't being offered spaces in other countries. So they needed another place they could move them to from Libya, and it became Rwanda. So I went to Rwanda. quite a few of my sources got evacuated after literally years with smugglers and then in detention centres. They were evacuated to Rwanda. And so I went there to meet them. And yeah, it's, I mean, that's the role that it's playing. It's basically opted to take people, but it's a tiny, tiny minority. And then even then they get moved to Rwanda, they wait again, you know, indefinitely sometimes just to find out, can they be evacuated to a safe country? So it's a very long process.
Mm. So I did want to come to this chapter of your book, which is titled, The SIM Card is Our Life. So there's so many stories in your book that we won't have time to go through them all. But tell me the story of the first person who contacted you, and you'd already begun to say how vital the SIM card is for him and for really the others.
Yeah, I mean, that's how the book opens. It, the prologue was called The SIM Card is Our Life, because that's what one of the refugees who first contacted me said. So it was August 2018. That's when I got this message, basically from on Facebook, from someone saying, hi, Sister Sally, we need your help. We're under bad condition in Libya prison. If you have time, I'll tell you all this story. And so I mean, sometimes I get these messages as a journalist. You always kind of say, I can't help, because, you know, you don't want to make false promises. But I said, I can't help, but of course I'll listen if you want to tell me what's going on. And so this guy said there were hundreds of them. They had been locked in a detention center for months. A war had just broken out around them. And the guards who had locked them inside basically had fled. And so they had been left there. They had no food, no water. There were children. There were pregnant women. They were desperate. They didn't know. He sent me photos of, like, you know, people patrolling, like militias patrolling outside. And they were just desperate for help. And so I obviously was a bit skeptical. Like, I was like, how could this be real? Why are they contacting me? How do they have a phone? But I knew a Libyan journalist who was in Tripoli at the time. And I said, I mean, has a war just broken out? And he said, yes. And I said, would it make sense that there are like 500 refugees in this area locked in some sort of prison? And he said, yes. And then I said, basically at that point I was like, okay, well, maybe this is real. So I started contacting NGOs, the UN, anyone that I could think of, asking, could they help? Like, do they have more information? The guy who had contacted me first, I asked him for a GPS location, selfies, you know, anything I could think of that would prove that they were where they said they were. Even I think I asked for his family members' contacts, because I wanted to call them and just kind of confirm. And yeah, it turned out that this was totally real. And from that point then, that was the first group. I thought it was an isolated incident, basically. But like I said, it turned out that they had pretty much all tried to cross the Mediterranean Sea and been intercepted because of European policy, and been locked up in this detention center where they ended up in this situation. But from that point, I started actually posting the messages on Twitter, because I was, you know, anonymously, but I was like trying to get them help, and everyone I contacted said they couldn't help them. And then I started getting contacted by people in other detention centers. So it turned out that this wasn't isolated, that there were like many, I mean, at one point there were 26 like government affiliated detention centers, but that were being run by militias where people were locked up. So that was the basis of the book, that I then became the contact person for like refugees that were detained all over Libya. And yeah, I just wanted to document what was happening to them.
Yeah, you describe in the book, you know, it was quite extraordinary how they were hiding the phones, hiding the SIM card. You wrote about hiding it in their cheeks. They were taking them out at night and using wires to find the one electric outlet they had to power the phones. I mean, just, you know, that was a great way to start the book, Sally. Just really gave us a sense of, you know, of the extraordinary measures that people were taking. You mentioned already a bit on the UN. I wanted to take you to another refugee that you quoted, who had written to you and said, the UN can't do anything. I have lost hope from the UN and from anyone. So tell me about your reporting of the UN agencies responsible for refugees.
I had actually reported, so I didn't know this when I received this first message, I wasn't aware, but the reason that they contacted me was actually because of my reporting previously in Sudan. That meant that my name was quite well known among refugees. So one of the guys who was in this detention center, his brother had recommended my name. And that reporting in Sudan had ended up focusing on UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency. So I went to Sudan 2017. I was actually initially looking at EU funding and how that was being used to stop migration and where it was being spent. But all the refugees that I spoke to, they were like, no, don't report on this, report on how the UN is corrupt. And so I, of course, like for me, I was like, that doesn't make sense. I had thought, especially the UN Refugee Agency, you know, in my head, it was like really doing amazing work. I had always admired them a lot. And they said, no, what is happening? So there's this legal resettlement, you know, what people say, the legal routes. And they were saying that actually UNHCR is in charge of that process in Sudan. And they were saying that UNHCR staff were involved in taking bribes of up to like tens of thousands of dollars from refugees to be considered for this program. And so I looked into this for like 10 months because I didn't want to publish anything quickly because I was like, this really seems very strange to me. And I actually ended up interviewing both a lot of refugees, but also former UNHCR staff who said, yes, this has been a problem. And I ended up publishing the investigation in May 2018. And 2 days later, UNHCR in Sudan suspended the resettlement program, saying that they were carrying out an anti-fraud investigation. And that basically, again, punished vulnerable people, really, because then there was no resettlement, which, you know, they desperately needed. And they did eventually find one staff member guilty of soliciting bribes and abusing power. Though refugees there, they say that the situation was bigger than that and that it's ongoing. So Sudan, for people that don't understand the geography, Sudan is kind of like the transit country for people who are trying to get to Europe from East Africa and the Horn of Africa. And they're going then to Libya. And so refugees in Sudan, they would say this process is corrupt. So we can't get a legal route to safety, you know, unless we have huge amounts of money. So that's why we take this illegal route, even though you said, you know, the amount you pay traffickers is huge. At the same stage, they were saying it's cheaper than trying to go through the so-called legal route. So yeah, that was my first reporting on UNHCR. And then in Libya as well, I mean, I tried to document it. Basically, I was just looking at the disconnect between what was being said by them publicly and what was being said by refugees in detention centers, and just trying to make sure that the, you know, that the voices of the refugees were also being heard in this, because a lot of the time in, for example, official meetings with politicians, all of this, you'll have UN staff representing the viewpoint of refugees. But in Libya, there's a big disconnect between the refugees and the UN staff, because, you know, if you have people in detention centers, for example, UNHCR staff have to call up before they turn up to a detention center. Then the refugees know if they say certain things, they can be tortured by the Libyan guards. It's not UNHCR that runs the centers. It's Libyan militias, effectively. And so, you know, again, you have a disconnect, because then what's being heard is what UNHCR may say instead of what the refugees are saying. And yeah, for me, it became very clear that those weren't the same things.
We make a lot of stuff here at Intelligence Squared. So many great chats to enrich the mind, like the one you're listening to now. But like any business, it's really essential to be in good shape and keep things efficient, so you can see the big picture all in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems, and it's super easy to get started because NetSuite exists in the cloud, so no hardware needed, cutting your IT costs too. And you'll also improve efficiency by bringing all your major processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. The cost of living crisis might not be making anything any cheaper, but there's real value in feeding feeling on top of things, which is something I experience firsthand as an event producer every day. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared. Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents with the code squared. Simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code squared to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV.
You mentioned there the EU, and you had actually also written about really the impact of the arrivals of refugees from these countries that you are covering into Europe. And so this, you know, around 2015, we said around 2016. So just talk through a bit about your reporting on the EU funds and just say a bit more about what you described as the so-called European refugee crisis, which then, you know, you do focus on in the book as well. And also just tell me if, and remind me if I forget to ask, when you actually went to a port and you were trying to document what was happening with some of the arrivals into Italy.
Yeah, sure. I mean, even this term, like the European refugee or migrant crisis, that's something that a lot of people who work on this sort of area dispute, because it's really a crisis for the refugees, isn't it? And we had the EU in 2019 came out and said the migrant crisis is over 2 months ahead of elections, when they were worried that the far right was going to gain ground, basically. But I think, like, from my book, you can see the crisis isn't over. It's just been pushed into a situation where refugees aren't being listened to, or where people are suffering, but it's not been documented. They're not being registered. Like, for example, the number of deaths happening in Libyan detention centres is not being counted by anyone. And there are a lot of them.
Yes. No, I think you describe it in both the book and just earlier as the so-called European refugee crisis. So it's, you know, just to get a sense of, especially now as we're looking at the Ukraine, just to get a sense of your reporting on the UN, on the EU funds, and, you know, and the implications of, you know, of all of that, the politics and the funding and, you know, and then your own trip.
So like I said, the 2015, that kind of led to a lot of repercussions in terms of European migration policy and in terms of how that has hardened. And one of the things that resulted was, it's called the EU Trust Fund for Africa. So it's a multi-billion euro pot of money that's being spent, I think, still over 26 African countries. And it basically kind of declares them as being in crisis. So there isn't the same oversight in terms of this spending as there is on other EU spending. And the money is effectively being paid to try and stop migration through like a huge range of means. So the Libyan Coast Guard money is coming out of that. That's tens of millions of euro. And then, you know, there's various other, there's a lot of other spending as well. Even the UN is receiving a lot of money through that. And then, yeah, I think there are a lot of allegations in terms of that money, whether it's actually propping up kind of in Libya militias, I mean, repressive governments in other places, increasing securitization, increasing abuses, because it's kind of more focused on hardening borders rather than actually, you know, improving things for the people who needed it, particularly in some countries. And in Libya, I mean, that's what refugees who were locked in detention would say, like, if all this money is being spent, why are we not, you know, they would eat, for example, one piece of bread a day, or like, one small bowl of like pasta, but with nothing on it. And so refugees who I interviewed, they lost like 30, some of them 25, 30 kilos in detention. Like they were literally starving. Like people died of pretty much starvation. And yeah, like you have this money being spent, but then I don't know, people are suffering. So, I mean, it's a big, I go into it a lot more in the book, mm-hmm. like you're saying, but that's kind of like a general overview. Mm-hmm. Sorry, you wanted to ask me in terms of Upwards?
Yeah. So you write one of the chapters about some of the, you know, throughout the book, you know, you document a lot of the challenges that you had. You were receiving threats. But you did actually go to a port, didn't you? Because you went to many places. But I thought that story where you then became persona non grata. So just tell us that story.
I went on a refugee boat, which was, I think it was December 2019 to New Year 2020. And it was run by CI, a charity called CI from Germany. And yeah, reporting this book, there were many things that ended up happening, which I did not anticipate. And if I had tried to, you know, write it obviously it's nonfiction, so you have to roll with what you find. But if I had anticipated things, they wouldn't have necessarily been how things developed. And this was one example that we went on this rescue ship. I assumed that we were going to rescue people from detention centers, potentially even people that I had been in touch with, or, you know, Eritreans, Sudanese people, Somalis. And instead, we ended up rescuing Libyans. 32 Libyans came on board. And that was really interesting to me, because then I was asking, like, why are you guys fleeing? And they said, you know, their country is being ruled by militias. And it comes back to that EU funding, actually. Like, they said it had become unlivable. Like, it wasn't safe to be there. It was so dangerous. And yeah, it was just militia rule. It's not like, you know, a safe place to be. And for me, that led back to the question, well, isn't this EU funding kind of propping up those militias? Is there a potential that it's actually making the country unlivable now, even for Libyans? Yeah, in terms of the allegations that I was then under, I don't know if I should explain it properly here, or it's better that people read the book, to be honest, because it's kind of a legal issue. But yeah, I did then, I was put under investigation for being a human smuggler, essentially. And that lasted 1 year and then was dropped.
I want to ask you a little bit. There's so many stories that are so poignant in your book. But if you described, you've already described, you know, quite a bit of it. But I was fascinated to learn that the refugees in these detention centers, they would, they would pair up because married couples had, you know, they were higher up in terms of being resettled. So just kind of, you know, say a bit more about, you know, what you observed these refugees doing to try and, you know, survive and make it out.
Yeah, I mean, so I guess this book, I just wanted to document actually humanity and how humanity survives in these type of horrific situations. And, you know, the fact that anyone can survive living like this for years, like literally years, to me is incredible. And this was one of the things that I did hear about happening a good bit, was that because there'd be less women basically than men, but married couples, so either women were prioritized, women and children, or married couples as well. There were, and I heard this from like many people, that's why it's documented, there were kind of basically women either doing favors almost, so they'd like enter into relationships with men that weren't real and be evacuated with them. And actually, like, from what I heard, a lot of those couples stayed together. So, you know, it started, I quote someone, he says it started as a game and then they had a baby. Like, it started that it was kind of like one person doing the other one a favor, or, you know, even just because everybody was kind of trying to help each other in a way. And that's what really, like, reporting this, I was amazed. I think that people, even in the toughest circumstances, they try and do what they can to help each other. I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but like that's what I heard about anyway. And Yeah, you had these couples that, like, sometimes they wouldn't even have met in person. They'd write each other letters from different cells in detention centres or from different halls. Then they'd agree that they'd be evacuated together, and then they'd end up in a relationship. And some of them are, you know, like, pretty happy and in love now, which is kind of crazy.
So you've discussed around East Africa and some of the routes that people take. Just say a bit about the refugees from West Africa.
Yeah, the people coming from West Africa, generally they wouldn't be considered refugees in a legal sense. They'd be more what's termed economic migrants. They're people who have left looking for opportunity, or they fled from poverty, or things like that. But that was one of the interesting things for me. I went to Sierra Leone and I met one guy who was from Sierra Leone, who had been messaging me from inside detention. They don't have the opportunity to be legally evacuated. And so a lot of them end up, when they get locked in detention, their only way out is to be returned to their home country through an EU-funded UN scheme. And so he got returned. But I ended up reporting in Sierra Leone a lot. And, you know, for me, that challenged the idea of the distinction between refugees and economic migrants, because, for example, in Sierra Leone, your life expectancy is around 25 years less than it would be in Europe. I think it's around 1 in 10 children die before they turn 5. It's one of the worst, if not the worst, country to give birth as a woman. You're very likely to die. And so there are these threats to your life that are related to poverty but are still kind of, you know, I was even there during a big coronavirus outbreak, and there were no ventilators functioning in the country. So, like, if you needed a ventilator, you just died. So that's, when you look at it like that, it's not so clear cut that these are just people who want a job. You know, it's like there is actually an active threat to your life if you're in a very, very poor country.
One of the things that was, there are many striking things about your book, but one of the striking things is that you write that 87% of the world's refugees are sheltered in developing countries. And you view migration as one of the greatest challenges to humanity of the 21st century. So what would you like to see done about this crisis, this challenge?
I mean, I wouldn't necessarily say that I see migration as one of the greatest challenges. It's more the response to it. I think that it's really a test of people's humanity, because we're really seeing the worst of, you know, our humanity as people who are living in the rich world. What is happening? For me, I'm a journalist. You know, I don't have all the answers, but I want people to know the consequences of our policies. And I feel like we're all complicit in this, really, because so many efforts are being made to shut out people and literally incarcerate them, and sometimes sentencing them to death effectively. And I think that all Europeans should be aware of this. I mean, I know there's been Brexit. I think British people should also be aware of it. Even the British have been involved in training the Libyan Coast Guard as well. So it isn't a separate issue. And yeah, I mean, I talk about it in the book. We have all this kind of pieces being written saying things like, how do we make more women have babies in the West, because we have declining populations? But actually, it's like Africa is treated as an oversight in those sort of conversations. And you have huge numbers of people who are looking for opportunities, but have been shut out from those opportunities. And, you know, people now, they're saying, well, we should care more about Ukrainians, for example, because we have more of a history with Ukraine. But actually, a lot of African countries were former colonies of British, either Britain or European countries, and they've long been exploited by British and European countries. Yeah, I think that there's a bigger responsibility there that's somehow being dodged.
You write that Samuel went to Canada. You also write about Millian going to Sweden, Essie went to Italy, and others. So you mentioned it's at the very start. What is the process like for those who make it to Europe or to Canada and elsewhere? And do you know how they're doing now?
Yeah, there are two ways that people that I've been in touch with, they've made it. Either that they cross the sea, so they keep trying and eventually they make it across the sea to Italy or to Malta, or else they get resettled through the UN, which, like I said, that's a small number, but there is a number that get taken like that. And yeah, they're the lucky few, to be honest. And I think they all struggle. I mean, I document that in the book as well, like that I went around Europe meeting former Libya detainees who pretty much all have problems sleeping. Like they don't sleep at night. They end up just pacing around at night. They like either cut contact with people in Libya or they struggle in various ways. And at the same stage, like some of them have jobs now, they can speak fluent, you know, Swedish or Norwegian, or they're learning languages. They're like integrating in various ways. Some are part of sports clubs. So they, yeah, but it's tricky. And I met two guys in Stockholm, I describe it in the book, who were held in a detention center called Zintan. One of them lost 25 kilos there. One of them lost 30 kilos there. They thought they were going to die. They were completely emaciated. And we met for lunch and it was very strange because they were describing how it had been. And I was messaging them when they were in this detention center. They were describing how it was to starve there. And then we're sitting in Sweden and we're in this restaurant with like a lot of food in front of us. They were telling me, you know, if this was a Libyan detention center, this is how the mattresses would be lined up, this is how many people would be fit in here. And they then said, one of them picked up a glass of water and said, you know, I think one of them got a bit upset and I said, we don't have to talk about this, you know, it's fine. And he said, no, I want to talk about this. And then he picked up a glass of water and said something like, the people here, they don't see past this glass. He tried to use it as an example. And he was like, they don't understand what's happening to us. And because of that, we can't speak about it. We don't, you know, it just disturbs people for them to speak. Another guy said he had tried to describe it to someone and they said, wow, this is like a movie. And he was like, no, this is the reality for like tens of thousands of people who are still going through this. So they really have like this very difficult time trying to reconcile. Even in Sweden, refugees kept saying, we can't believe how well they treat their dogs here. Like they're so nice to their animals. And yet, you know, Africans are suffering this much on the borders. So yeah, it's very difficult. And I don't know the answers. I've been trying to learn a bit more about trauma and how it affects people. And I hope that they'll all do well and continue to do well. But I know that it's difficult.
Well, you're right that some have been returnees back to West Africa. There's a story you tell in the book about one of them.
Yeah, about Joseph. And he, yeah, exactly. Like I was saying, I went to visit him there. And it's difficult. I mean, he actually just wants to leave again. Like he's looking for opportunities. He tried to get a job. He's had various problems. I mean, I detail it in the book. But yeah, like, and that's what I said earlier about this difference between refugees and economic migrants. I mean, there's a legal difference there in that one is entitled to international protection if they can reach a country where they can claim it in. Whereas like Joseph, he could get to Europe and he probably wouldn't get it, you know. But at the same stage, yeah, it's difficult to be in like a country where you don't have a social security net, you don't have, you know, you have extreme poverty, you have nepotism. Yeah, it's hard.
And Sally, one of the questions that has come in for you is, aside from Europe, which we've discussed, what do you think other countries' responsibilities should be in this crisis?
I mean, again, I wouldn't necessarily call it a crisis, except for that, like you said, 87% of refugees are sheltered in developing countries. So I guess for a lot of them, it is a crisis. But I think that, you know, legal paths to safety are very important. And that's not just through refugee resettlement, which is important, but that's offering scholarships, offering, you know, job opportunities, different ways that people can find to access those opportunities, basically, because the reality is that we're all just kind of where we're born is chance. And then some of us have extreme privileges and some people have none. And it's hard to understand that if you're born into a rich country, but actually the difference is huge. And then, yeah, I mean, I don't know, like the broader issue is obviously inequality as well as, you know, stopping wars and dictatorships, but yeah, more empathy. I mean, for me, I just wanted to document the consequences of this policy. I want people to be aware of what's happening, but I think that, of course, we can all be more empathetic.
In terms of for other, you know, for countries, You know, what is the one thing you would like for them and their people to feel after they read your book and after your reporting?
I guess I'm hoping that both people are more empathetic, but also there are questions around accountability and justice. And I detail those in the book as well. I don't know if they're going to come to anything, but I know that, you know, there's a lot that has gone wrong that actually there should also probably be accountability for.
So just finally, Sally, in your author's note, you write that whenever you speak in public, members of the audience, they want to know how all of this reporting has affected your mental health, your well-being. And I know you're sometimes reluctant, but will you share with our audience how this has been for you?
Yeah, I mean, I write in the author's notes that basically I always get asked that. And I think that there is the uncomfortableness in terms of reporting on this type of topic that people are more interested in focusing particularly on like a white person, like a white individual, rather than looking at the broader issues. And that's why that question makes me quite uncomfortable, is that actually everybody should be engaging with this topic. It shouldn't be a way of shirking responsibility or shirking being aware of it. And I write that in the book, like how often do people read of, for example, a Mediterranean drowning and then just kind of close the tab or turn away? I think that everyone should be paying attention. In terms of my reporting, I mean, I detail in the book as well, like I faced death threats, I was under criminal investigation, like I've been very scared for a lot of this period of time. But yeah, I still don't think the focus should be on me, because that's, if more people were doing this type of work, which is what we need, then, you know, it would be better.
Thank you very much, Sally Hayden, for a fascinating conversation. Your book actually reminds me of a quote from the former publisher of the Washington Post, Philip Graham, who said, "Journalism is the first rough draft of history." I encourage all of our viewers and listeners to pick up her new book, which is out today. It's My Fourth Time We Drowned, Seeking Refuge on the World's Deadliest Migration Route. Sally is donating a portion of the proceeds from the sales to refugee supporting initiatives. And thank you all for joining us. I'm Linda Yu, and you've been listening to Intelligence Squared.